Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just tuning in for the first time, here's what we do on A Cast of Kings. We spoil everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones, but that does not include anything from future week's episodes. And that even includes, in that description, anything from the next time on preview in Game of Thrones that HBO often airs. But this week we'll spoil everything through Season 4, Episode 3, entitled Breaker of Chains. You can find more episodes of our podcast at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. We love to read your emails and respond to them. But before we get to any of that, Joanna Robinson, we got to make an announcement this week that, hey, guess what? Joanna Robinson and I actually created our first video product together, did we not, Joanna?
We did do that.
We did. We made a video. It was a mashup of Frozen and Game of Thrones. It was a sort of music video for Let It Go, but Let It Go spelled with G-O-T. And yeah, this thing kind of caught fire a little bit on the internet. As of right now, it has over 300,000 views. It appeared on Rolling Stone, People magazine. But it debuted initially at the Cast of Kings Twitter account. From that one tweet to hundreds of thousands of views. And we appreciate your guys' support and spreading it.
We did so much this week. We created a Twitter account and we made a video.
Exactly. You can follow it at twitter.com/acastofkings. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/acastofkings. And I would recommend you follow us, like us, tweet at us at those locations if you want to be the first to find out about cool stuff like our Let It Go music video. Who knows what other crazy stuff we'll create throughout the rest of the season. I hope we create something, Jonah, because now I've just like built it up a lot. So,
oh, no.
Anyway, you can find that video at twitter.com/acastofkings or on facebook.com/acastofkings. One thing I'd also ask is if you are a fan of A Cast of Kings, if you could leave us a review on iTunes, we would greatly appreciate it. A lot of Game of Thrones podcasts out there, John Robinson, people turn to the reviews to try and figure out which one to listen to. If you are a supporter of this show, we just ask that you give us a quick star rating or leave us a review. So let's get into the show, Joanna. A lot of people writing in to acastofkings@gmail.com, mostly writing in to express their vehement disagreement with pretty much any opinion I voice. And I don't say that, you know, I'm not saying that as like, oh, I'm a victim or anything. I just mean like, it's just coincidentally, this is what people happen to be saying all the time. And this email, and here's the thing. The emails are actually really great and often end up changing my opinion on things. So I appreciate you guys writing in. This one comes in from Ashley. Ashley writes in, quote, "I thought you guys might be interested in this one psychologist's harrowing description of what torture, particularly prolonged torture, is designed to do. Some choice quotes. There is one place in which one's privacy, intimacy, integrity, and inviolability are guaranteed. One's body, a unique temple, and a familiar territory of sensa and personal history. The torturer invades, defiles, and desecrates the shrine. In a way, the torture victim's own body is rendered his worst enemy. It is corporeal agony that compels the sufferer to mutate his identity, to fragment his ideals and principles, to crumble. The body becomes an accomplice of the tormentor, an uninterruptible channel of communication, a treasoned poison territory." I'm skipping ahead in this email. In this sense, while harrowing to watch, the torture of Theon is, I would argue, one of the most accurate depictions of torture and its ultimate consequences that we have seen in the media. Theon is trapped in a world in which reality is constructed for him by Ramsay Snow, and what we see as he breaks down is his gradual willingness to participate in that reality. What we see in Theon in this last episode are symptoms of dissociation and depersonalization. This is why it's plausible for Theon to have no will to kill Ramsay, because not only has Theon been bereft essentially of ego and free will, but because torture fosters dependency between the abuser and the abused. It is far more likely that Theon internalizes Ramsay's dehumanization of him and perpetuates the abuse within his own psyche. In other words, Theon is more likely to be suicidal than homicidal, end quote. So great email from Ashley there, and a lot of people wrote in complaining about my views on Theon. And I think I actually, like, for the most part, I'm swayed by the emails. I think that I think what you heard on the podcast last week was me trying to square how relentlessly unpleasant and unnecessary I felt the Theon scenes were last season with what the payoff was for those this season. And a part of me felt like it was an inadequate payoff, but upon reading the emails, I do think that there was some method to the madness. Jonah Robinson, any further thoughts on this?
Well, I just want to say, I mean, I just want to echo something of what you said, which is that how much we appreciate this input, because as much as, you know, we love thinking about and writing about and talking about this show, like last week I didn't feel comfortable at all being an expert on the psychology of torture. And then we got several emails from people who actually have that background. And so that really helps inform us and help inform the audience as well. So anytime you hear us talking about something that you happen to be an expert in and we're wrong about, please do write in.
Yeah. I think that happened last season. Wasn't it? Didn't we ask about like something, or actually I think this is Breaking Bad. We asked about, when we did our The Ones Who Knock podcast, we asked about like legal questions surrounding Walter White, and we actually got responses from lawyers.
Yeah, and then when we did, I think it was like season two of this podcast. I mean, granted, we were talking about like body hair on women or something
that's
like
right.
that, and yeah. we got this great like historical email about it. So you know, like, we really do appreciate everyone's insight.
Right.
Especially when you're telling us how wrong.
Especially when you're telling me how grossly misguided my viewpoints are. I do appreciate it, and I say that completely seriously. So thanks for writing in, guys. And I think I need to put more thought into the Theon situation before I can fully articulate any well-reasoned viewpoint on that particular storyline.
But it is really interesting to think about the attachment, which is like an established notion of the psychology of torture, the attachment that the tortured forms with the torturer, and to think about the Reek or AKA Theon and Ramsay plotline, you know, in the next couple episodes if we see more of them.
Right. I mean, I guess I would say, you know, that okay, so the story is like an accurate depiction of what I guess here would be my response to Ashley and other similar emails is, okay, yes, this is an accurate depiction of the results of torture, right? Is it, I guess, like, my initial question is to ask, like, is it necessary to depict torture in the way that they did? And I guess my, like, you know, having read all these emails, I would say, like, my first response to that would be, for the most part, yes. I mean, even this idea of Ramsay, like, making Theon think that he's escaped, but then he's not, right? And how, mm-hmm. like, pissed off that plotline made me, because I felt like it was spinning its wheels. It does end up kind of having some meaning here, right? Because if they, you know, learned helplessness is a real psychological phenomenon, and that could be part of Ramsay's torturing regime. I guess because Ramsay seems so like such an unstable human being, it doesn't feel like there is a method to his madness, but apparently there is. And so you hear a sort of like tension in my voice and trying to like, you know, piece this together. And I guess that's kind of what you heard come out on the podcast last week. Speaking of which, I did get a response on the YouTube video that I did of the music in Game of Thrones, Jonah Robinson. Why, someone said something along the lines of, gotta admit, Dave, like, crap like this makes it really difficult to keep supporting you and listening to the podcast. Simply because I had spent so much time rooting for Arya, and then to voice objection into how the show finally paid off her psychotic tendencies. Mm-hmm. I guess people have just found that to be unacceptable. And I guess I'd have a couple of responses to that. The sort of direct response to that is that I think the Arya storyline, we want it to pay off, but the way that it does is, you know, like, it is kind of like, how would you describe that scene where she kills that guy who took Needle? I mean, it's essentially like a calculated scene, right? Like she is intending on creating some kind of altercation that's going to give her an opportunity to take back her sword and kill this guy, right? This is not some kind of accident that she just sort of stumbles into. Would you agree with that? Or
not quite.
Okay.
I think she and the Hound were provoking trouble. The Hound even more so than she was. But I don't think
it was like a premeditated murder.
I think she charged in there. I think given opportunity, yes, she would murder him. But right. I don't think that. I mean, calculated makes it sound more planned out than
right,
it was.
Like she had some plan to set this whole thing off. You're right. That is an unfair assessment. But I guess what I say, like, she went in there wanting to start trouble, and she knew that killing this guy was a significant possibility that could come out of that.
Right.
And so the number one response I would say is, like, I can root for Arya as a character, but when the character goes in a really sort of dark direction, in a way that's even darker than I would have anticipated, like, I feel like it's okay for me to have a problem with that. That's just my own take on it. But on top of that, people's feelings about art can sometimes be complex, I guess is what I would say. I know that's like that's kind of like a cop-out answer, but am I being unreasonable, Jonna? Do you feel like sometimes people can have complex feelings, or is it, you know,
of course.
Am I simply just maddening?
No, of course. We're all allowed to have, like, you know, we are going to talk about something later.
Yes.
In this episode that I have complex feelings about. So I don't know if you're setting me up for that. But yes, of course, complex feelings are, I think that's a hallmark of someone who's taking the art that they're digesting very seriously.
Right. And so I can understand why people might perceive it as infuriatingly self-contradictory, but know that it is not intended to be that. It's just the podcast is just us trying to express our feelings about what we see, and sometimes it can be self-contradictory, and it may not always make sense. But that's what we do here on A Cast of Kings.
So we try to be as unintelligible as possible.
Yeah, that's pretty much. So that being said, Jonna Robinson, let's get into the show.
Yeah,
and talk about what is going on in this episode. Mm-hmm. So as usual, let's like go plot line by plot line. But I guess, you know, the episode begins with moments after the last episode ended, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I believe these two episodes were shot back to back. Alex Graves directed both of them.
Yeah,
so,
same director. Makes sense.
So it makes sense that they would just like kind of chop these 2 hours and a half and make it these two episodes. And so Sansa escapes with Ser Dantos, and Tyrion is taken to prison because Cersei is convinced that he is the one who murdered Joffrey.
Right.
And I think the plot line we should discuss briefly is, like, you know, we see Baelish appear for the first time this season, right?
Yes.
And take Sansa aboard the ship and brutally murder Ser Dantos.
Poor Ser Dantos.
Yeah, he's not had a happy go of things. So yeah, that was kind of a bummer to see him brutally slaughtered after he went to all that trouble to save Sansa's life, and they had that touching scene.
But do you feel like it was touching, or do you feel like, you know, because then Baelish goes on to claim that Dantos was just doing what he was paid to do. So did it like cast a different light on those scenes, or do you still feel like Dantos is this somewhat sad and noble character, or is he just greedy?
I think the actors, I don't know who the actor is, but his face just makes him look very pitiable. And I don't say that in an insulting way, just like, because he's also dressed as a fool in these episodes.
Yeah.
My heart was just very sympathetic towards him. I mean, he doesn't seem like a threatening character. He certainly seems a lot less threatening and scheming than Baelish does.
You know, that's not hard, because unlike Joffrey, like, I'm pretty sure Littlefinger actually, like, twirls his mustache
right,
when he schemes his evil plots.
Right. He just is really a sketchy guy. And so compared to Baelish, you know, Ser Dontos seems like there's almost a kind of purity towards in Ser Dontos' actions. I mean, he was, you know, he didn't do anything explicitly evil from what I could tell. He helped Sansa out for money, so
yeah, it's not bad to profit from also doing something noble. And there, as I'm intimated in last week's podcast, I didn't want to talk too much about Ser Dontos, knowing like what was going to happen to him, lest I spoil something. But there is a lot of interaction between him and Sansa over the course of the books, and so.
So you don't get any of that plot here, right?
Right. It's not really. It's a lot of exposition and that sort of stuff, but. But yeah, he is just a very sad character, I think. So
yeah, I will say that you know, this episode's theme was essentially reminding us that every character in the show that you might have liked is an asshole. Like I realize that's like the theme of almost every single scene in this episode is, lest you forget, these are all terrible, terrible human beings.
Oh, I disagree with you.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll get to it.
No. I'm not even talking about that because, I mean, I don't want to skip ahead too much, but Pod.
Want to talk
about, like, one character who is virtuous in all of Westeros, Podrick Payne, you know?
Agreed. No, I agree that scene definitely stuck out, but I think there are many characters for whom we might have thought they were good. And or thought they were decent in some way, and then you know, they like this episode kind of like took them back down a few notches.
I don't even know what you could be referring to, but yeah, let's go ahead.
All right.
Sorry.
So we have some discussion with Olenna and Margaery, and Margaery is kind of lamenting the fact that she is not queen.
What did you make of this scene?
Well, it's always great
Lady
to see
Olenna. Yeah.
Always great to see Lady Olenna. And did I say Lady Olenna the first time?
You said Olenna.
Oh,
that's
sorry.
Okay, because
sorry.
we all like Mamet.
There's a restaurant in Boston I liked named Olenna, so I have it on the mind sometimes. But yeah, Lady Olenna and Margaery, great scene. I mean, I think it revealed. I liked that it gave us a little more insight into how calculating both of those characters are, right? Mm-hmm. And Margaery is a political genius, pretty much. Something we didn't mention last episode was how Cersei like totally tries to undermine Margaery, right? By
sending the leftovers to the dogs,
which like just reminds you how evil Cersei is. Like, she's not even willing to do this nice thing for people, even though it's like no skin off her back, right? Like,
exactly. Yeah.
So anyway. She was lamenting the fact that she could have been queen. Like, she was willing to do this terrible, terrible thing, marry Joffrey, just so she could be queen.
Right.
And you realize, like, it's totally all calculation and really well done calculation, but calculation nonetheless. Ditto Lady Olenna, who's talking about how I think she makes reference to how, like, the next one will be easier.
Right.
Referring to the fact that I believe that theoretically, under this new world order, Margaery is going to be marrying the next child of Cersei and Jaime, correct?
That was sort of Olenna's intimation.
Implication, right?
Yeah, that the Tyrells and the Lannisters, that union is still on the table.
It's still on the table, right. Yeah. And what's the name? Do you remember the name of Joffrey's brother?
I do. His name is Tommen.
Tommen, right. Which I thought was remarkable, because this character who no one knew who he even was potentially could become a significant character in the show.
I know. Wouldn't that be interesting? Like, everyone's been talking about who's going to sit on the throne. And wouldn't it be interesting if it's this...
If it's this complete unknown coming out of nowhere.
In the background.
Right.
And they recast him this season.
Oh.
A new actor. They aged him up a little, as they do with like all the kid actors on the show.
Right.
And that actor who's been cast actually played Martin Lannister, which is one of the boys.
Oh yeah, yeah. From last season, a couple seasons ago, right?
Yeah. And Yeah. So, you know, just recasting left and right on the show. There you go.
Yeah, so we'll see where that leads.
And I liked Prince Tom in his, you know, his scene that he had. I mean, I guess if you're gonna be a scene partner with Charles Dance, you need to up your game a little bit, right?
Yeah, and he did a great job. I mean, it just is fascinating to me that this is a show where a character who, like, the one characteristic I knew about him is that he found the show with the little people that Joffrey put on last episode funny, and was embarrassed by it. When Tyrion gave him a dirty look. That's the one thing I knew about this character. Now, potentially, might become a main character in the show. That's just awesome when you have a show that can just upend like the tables like that so quickly.
There's a great... If you go back and watch... I mean, it's a different actor. But if you go back and watch the first season, when the first episode, when Tyrion walks in to breakfast with Cersei and Jaime, and he's like... being funny and cute with Marcella, who is, you know, the youngest daughter, and Tommen, and they really like him. And all the other Lannisters are, other than Jaime, are such assholes to Tyrion. And so I always liked Tommen and Marcella because they liked Tyrion, and so they seemed like not as tainted as Joffrey, you know?
Right. Was this also this is also who, like, Cersei was theoretically going to poison at the end of season
right,
two, right?
She had on her lap.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you'll notice he's much older now.
Right, right.
So, yeah, yeah.
He can't sit on her lap anymore, or no. Not comfortably anyway.
I mean, that would be inappropriate, and the Lannisters are never inappropriate in their relations.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. Joanna, I almost feel like we should skip the scene and come back to it at the end, because I feel like it's going to take most of the time.
I'm down with that, but we should talk about Tywin, that whole speech.
Oh, yeah. Before we even get to that, you know... Going back a little bit, we mentioned Lord Baelish, and the one thing I want to say about that is that it's obviously very clear that Baelish was involved in the plot to kill Joffrey, but I would contend, based on what the show has shown us, that like the full extent of the plot has not been made clear yet. I mean, you don't know if there's anyone else involved, you don't know... Like, why, you know, Baelish doesn't like lay out what the reasoning was, what the purpose was, what was the whole game plan... that's not explained. So I'm actually hoping that will be explained in a future episode. I anticipate it will be. But the show is very much playing it as a mystery right now. And Tyrion kind of is himself trying to put the pieces together as he's in his jail cell later in the episode. So thought I'd just comment on like the state of the mystery in the context of the show for now. So, yeah, as you were saying, Joanna Robinson, Tywin has this speech that he gives to Tommen, and it's pretty intense. What are your thoughts on it?
We're going to get a little later to some other comments that director Alex Graves made on this episode, but I really liked him categorizing this as a verbal kidnapping of Cersei watching Tywin just take her son, basically. And I thought it was beautifully done. Charles Dance is so great. And, you know, this is not in the books. This is pure show. And
oh, really? All that dialogue as well?
Yeah, you know, and they've really just done such a good job of giving Tywin, giving Charles Dance so much more than Tywin has in the books.
Interesting. He's a major player in this episode. I mean, he has the Oberyn conversation as well. So
right, and there are. I'm like,
you're struggling with these spoilers.
No. No, I'm confident this is true, that there are no Tywin Lannister point of view chapters. You have characters who don't have point of view chapters, they end up being periphery of other people's stories. So Tywin doesn't have point of view chapters. And so, you know, like all that great stuff that we had with Arya and Tywin and all this great stuff that we had in this episode and elsewhere, they've just really made great use of Charles Dance. And a lot of people had a lot of complaints around this episode had to do with not just that one scene that we're going to get to, but like how much it is different from the books. And you know me, I can be an obnoxious book purist. But we all have to recognize the ways in which the show has made better use of certain characters. And this is one of them. Charles Dance as Tywin Lannister. Great performance, great character. So.
Yeah, agreed. Awesome scene. And the way he leads Tommen through his reasoning. And you as the viewer, know exactly what he's doing, and Tommen doesn't know it, so there's that dramatic irony there a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's really well executed, and funny, too, when he's trying to talk to him about sex. That's pretty hilarious. So things get pretty dark after that, but we're going to skip the scene and come back to it later. Do you feel
only,
okay?
Only, yeah, just try to remind me that there are echoes of that scene in the next scene that we're not talking about yet.
Okay.
It's okay if you forget. I'm just saying that is going to remind me.
So. All right. So there is a scene with Stannis. And remember that reason why Stannis didn't kill Davos last season, Joanna? It was to, like, so Davos could get all these houses together. Well, apparently he's not very good at that, right? But he comes up with this idea to what exactly? Right?
Yeah, we're a bit off the map of the book, but I did say last week to take a shot every time they mention the Iron Bag of Braavos.
Right.
And so I feel like in this episode we saw a light bulb go off over Davos's head.
Right, and he's writing to the Iron Bank as Stannis.
And it's not clear exactly the extent of his plan.
Yeah, what is going on. So should be interesting. It just is also...
Should it, though? I don't know that the Stannis stuff is borne out to be that interesting, but I do love the Davos character.
Yeah, the Davos character is
great.
And
the scene with Shireen, the young princess, and her teaching him how to read. It's very charming. I really love all that stuff.
Yes, so. And saying Knigget, that was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Was that a Monty Python reference?
Knigget, it could be. And it's also that way, and with Tywin's speech... is a fun way that the showrunners are working in some of that complex history that we don't get from the books.
Right.
You know, it's like Davos reading about certain knights or Tywin talking about certain kings. Anyway, yeah.
So I thought it's okay, but it's just interesting that his whole reason for not killing him was that he could help marshal these houses together. And Davos basically had no plan. Like his plan now is let's get money to buy people, right? That's his plan essentially, or that's what he wants to do. At least that's the last interaction he has with Stannis. And so we'll see where that goes. But it's not proving to be too interesting yet. Stannis does make the point that they burned the leech that had Joffrey's name on it, and Joffrey is dead. And they burned the leech with Renly's name as well, right? That they said was Renly, and he died as well, right? So far, the leeches as a method of predicting deaths are doing pretty well.
Close. What? So he burned one that said Robb Stark.
Robb Stark. I'm sorry, not Renly. I apologize.
Yeah. Said Joffrey. And one that said Balon Greyjoy.
Interesting. So far, the leeches are doing a pretty good job prognosticating.
Two out of three. And even Davos in this episode was like, all right, Melisandre might have some magic after all.
Yeah, okay. Maybe she has some skills.
But exactly.
So what else do we want to talk about before we take a quick break? We should mention that Oberyn, there's this scene with Oberyn in the brothel. And Oberyn's kind of expounding on his philosophy of being bisexual, right?
Yes. And which I liked.
Yeah, I thought that was enjoyable. It's kind of one of those moments when Game of Thrones is, illustrating this point in a way that in a setting that I personally would probably never find myself in, but that nonetheless, you know, his what he's saying probably has some level of universal applicability. Then Tywin comes in and offers him a seat on the trial to kind of determine who is responsible for Joffrey's death in exchange for justice against Clegane, right? Is it Clegane? The mountain? Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, so that I thought that was it's a great scene because these two great actors going head to head with each other, I really enjoyed. And trying to Charles Dance, I think this is the first moment I can recall in which I have seen him seen Tywin Lannister express any sort of weakness, right? Like there's that moment where Oberyn says like, I guess you need us, And there's this kind of pained expression on Tywin's face as he realizes that that is true. And he tries to say, like, we need each other as a kind of face-saving measure. I just thought that was fascinating because we've never seen Tywin admit weakness before, right? Like, can you recall?
I want to rewatch that scene because I didn't pick that up. So. Oh.
Yeah, I just thought that he had this kind of pained expression when Oberyn said that. Or he was certainly not happy about admitting that we need each other. Right.
He also flung a little accusation at Oberyn, right? If we want to keep up the like detective work of who is responsible, Oberyn knows studied poisons, right?
Right.
So that's, you know, one of the usual suspects, I guess.
Tywin is eliminating Oberyn from contention in the trial, essentially. I am curious how Oberyn is going to act against Tyrion. I don't think he has any specific beef against Tyrion, does he, right? Like, as far as we know in the show. They did have that uncomfortable interaction, but that was mostly because of Oberyn's beef against Tywin and not because of Tyrion.
Well, against all Lannisters. Right. Tyrion's a Lannister, you know.
I just feel like Oberyn's going to be a wild card in this trial, which is likely to be a sham anyway. But that's my guess.
That's a yeah.
You kind of just trailed off there, Jen. I didn't hear what you said.
Did I? What? I don't know. I really like that whole negotiation. And what Tywin did in that scene that is more important, I think, is throw Gregor Clegane under the bus.
Oh, yeah.
In order to get Oberyn's, you know,
cooperation. That's what I'm curious about is Tywin actually going to follow through with that? Mm-hmm. Right. Is he so ruthless that he would give up one of his own men for political gain? I think the answer is yes, is my guess. Like, he would be willing to do that. But he also strikes me like, because he's someone that ruthless, he's also someone that could just go back on his word against Oberyn. Right. Like, that's how much of a wild card he is. Like, he could just Tywin could do anything, as far as I'm concerned. He, like, for the betterment of his family and the kingdom and so on. So I don't know whether he's going to follow through with throwing Clegane under the bus, but it's a big question mark in my mind.
Right.
Anyway, you know, General Robinson, I should point out that someone sent in an email this week about how next level you are at not spoiling things. And I do want to say, like, we should take a moment just to salute the fact that you do a really good job of not spoiling future books.
Thank you.
In any regard. And it was an occasionally painful process to get us to this point. But I think you're like one of the best non-spoiler, like, I my complete trust is in you to not spoil.
Oh dear.
Oh
no. Yeah. I shared a car with someone this weekend for a total of like 7 hours, and she's like smack dab in the middle of watching Breaking Bad. And I'm not going to spoil anything Breaking Bad, don't worry, but you know, she was talking to me about theories, and she kept saying like, don't spoil. I was like, I know. I was like, don't worry. I got this.
I got this one, guys. Got this one. Yeah. Well, Joanna, like, I don't think, I guess the only thing I just want to say is, like, for non-book readers who listen to this podcast, Joanna is ridiculously good at non-spoiling things. And you know, it's very hard for me to read other sites because I always am afraid that they will casually spoil something. Even things that people don't think are spoilers are often spoilers. And so, you know, Joanna, you're awesome, basically, is what I'm trying to say. So
I thank you. But I should say the other thing that I did last week, I guess, is I am doing a segment over on the Fighting in the War Room podcast that where I do get to talk about spoilers, which is a great relief to let that out and not spoil any of you who are listening. So if you subscribe to Fighting in the War Room podcast, I'm just doing like a quick, probably like 20 to 30 minute segment there each week for the rest of the run talking about book spoilers. So,
all right. Well, for those who are in spoiler land, go there and comment there. Do not comment.
Yeah. Don't bring your comments here. Yeah,
do not comment spoilers on slashfilm.com or Facebook. a lot of people think they're being clever by hinting at things. It's just going to get you banned, and we don't want that. Like, trust me, guys, it is not worth it to show off your book knowledge because you will be banned. We want everyone to have a non-spoiler environment where they can talk about the show and have a good time. So just be careful with the spoilers out there. Anyway, John Robinson, this podcast is only possible through the donations and support of people on Kickstarter. We got a lot of Kickstarter support this year, and every episode there is a backer. This week's backer is the Screeners Podcast. That's at screenerspodcast.com. That's screenerspodcast.com. The Screeners Podcast is a group of four friends, all with current or former jobs in media production, who got tired of arguing about movies in private. Every couple weeks, whenever they can align their schedules, they get together to talk about new movies, TV shows, video games, and even a book or two. Come for Chris's unbridled enthusiasm. Stay to hate Josh's unapologetic elitism. Chad and Melody are there too, and we're sure their opinions are totally worthwhile, but they didn't write this bio, so... anyway, just this year, the Screeners have covered everything from the Lego Movie to True Detective and a ton of other stuff in between, including advancements in indie content distribution, retreats in the quality of award shows, and the hottest game on the Xbox One. Head over to iTunes and subscribe to the Screeners Podcast, where all media is appreciated, but none is safe. That's screenerspodcast.com, screenerspodcast.com. Sounds like they cover a lot of interesting topics that we would also cover if our podcast was more about just Game of Thrones, right, Joanna Robinson?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so a lot of good stuff there, and I would highly recommend you check out screenerspodcast.com. A lot of podcasts start with just a couple of people arguing about stuff. In fact, I'd argue that's how the best podcasts begin, is just people with strong opinions that can articulate them clearly and get in a room and kind of duke it out. And sounds like the Screeners Podcast offers plenty of that. So check it out at screenerspodcast.com. We also want to thank all the people that donated $10 to the show. And in exchange, you get to hear us butchering your name and thanking you here on A Cast of Kings. Joanna Robinson, you want to start and let us know, who do you want to thank this episode?
Okay, I definitely want to thank Brian Trawick. I certainly want to thank Annalisa Ulbrich. I'd be remiss if I didn't thank Adam Wells, Peter Fulton, Vic Digital, Millicent, Alain and Truly Stone, Nuria M, Jake Kirkendall, Mick Swagger.
I don't believe that's a real person's name.
But I love it, Mick Swagger. Mateus and Sean Stringfield. Thank you guys so much.
I was wondering if you're going to come up with like 10 like synonyms for a thank, or how you wanted to thank people.
I was getting a little precious, so I decided to drop it.
I would certainly like to thank Konstantinos Simonides.
I feel like we butchered Konstantinos' name for like three seasons.
Many times. So. Many times. He's a return glutton for punishment.
Butchery, yeah.
Thanks to Jason Butchery, is that a word? Thanks to Jason Lippert, Hugo Rios, Keith Alejandro, A La the Lady Gaga Song, great song, Brian Stone, Badder Fikri, Joe Opsetnik, Paul Miller, Patrick Zeising, Mark Riccini, Daniel Kakesi, Yohei Kaplan, and Stephen Hopkins. Thank you guys for your support of the Kickstarter. Joanna, I think you had one shout out you wanted to give as well, right?
I did. I want to give a shout out to Leah and Lou. Thank you guys so much.
Yes. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you all for the Kickstarter backers for, you know, showing your support, and thanks to screenerspodcast.com for sponsoring this episode. All right. Let's move on. A couple more scenes to discuss before we get to that scene. There is a scene with Sam and Gilly, where they kind of have this awkward conversation, and Sam is, I guess, unwilling to admit his feelings for Gilly in any sort of socially palatable way.
Sam.
And decides to deal with his emotions and protectiveness by putting her into a brothel, where, like, getting her a job at a brothel. Is that right? Did I read that correctly? Which is like, man, that's... That person that was talking with Gilly, that was a scary woman. I just want to say that. Like,
whatever the gender of that person, and I wasn't 100% sure, terrifying, terrifying person.
Yeah. She was very. I think it was her. It was very scary, and just the way she spoke was really menacing. And you felt
she was like, she's like, "Are you fucking wilding?" It's like, oh my god, I don't know what.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Sorry.
Very scary. Yeah. And you really get the sense that Gilly is like way worse off in this situation than she was.
Do you? Because there was that great scene where they were like, rapist, rapist, murder.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. I don't know.
She's stuck between a rape and a whorehouse. And like, not that I want to make any rape jokes on this particular podcast at all, or ever. I'm just saying Gilly is in a no-win situation where she is right now.
It's true, but I guess in one situation, at least like Sam is near her, do you know? And I don't know. Like, I interpreted this as Sam is kind of is acting out for his over. He knows he can't protect her, and he's doing something about it, but it's not like the most healthy thing to do, I guess, is kind of what my interpretation. But you have a different interpretation. It sounds like you think it was a totally reasonable move.
No. But I think we're all experiencing frustration with Sam when, you know, Gilly's like, "Are you tired of me?" And you're just like, "Sam, tell her you love her." And poor Sam is just not. No.
Right. I mean, you can only take impotence. I don't mean literally impotence. I mean, like, you can only take impotence in a character so often before it becomes really tiresome. Like, and you're just like, dude, just tell her what you think. So anyway, we'll see how this pans out for Gilly. I'm guessing it's not going to be good, but who knows what happens at Castle Black. Anyway. So then there's a scene where, like, I thought this was mildly confusing when those guys make it back from Craster's Keep, right?
Yeah.
And they're saying, I don't even remember, like, how they were at Craster's Keep at the last, like, I'll be honest, I didn't recall that they were kind of captive at Craster's Keep.
Well, they weren't captive, so they were there for the mutiny.
Right.
When Lord Mormont was killed. There was a mutiny, and basically they're the sympathizers who got out of there.
Right.
So it's Dollars Ed, who's like a friend of John's and stuff like that, and they made it back.
Right.
So they're reporting on the mutiny, which hadn't been reported to the Wall yet. Like, this is the first hearing of Lord Mormont's death, right?
So in the time that John was being captured by wildlings, like, they were just making their way back to the Wall? Is that what we're supposed to assume?
Yeah, the timeline's a little muddy.
Yeah, that's the only thing I thought was that actually wasn't what I thought was most weird. It was, as far as I can tell, the rationale is we can't let the issue I had is that Mance Rayder is intending to attack the Wall, right? Correct?
Yes.
Like, he said he's going to light this fire, and that's the
biggest fire the North has ever seen.
And that is the that is going to be the trigger or the inciting event for all the people, all the wildlings from all over, south and north of the Wall, to attack Castle Black. Is that right? Do I got that right so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So then John is saying, okay, well, we can't let those guys live at Craster's Keep. We got to go kill them, because if Mance Rayder finds them, then they will tell Mance Rayder that we are woefully unequipped for any such attack.
Yeah.
Is that right? But I guess Mance Rayder is already going to attack anyway. So why is it necessary to off these dudes? Do you know what I mean? Like, Mance Rayder thinks they have
a... element of surprise. I don't know. It's not. I agree with you.
Okay.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Because Mance Rayder is saying he's going to attack. He thinks there's 1,000 dudes at Castle Black.
But from like a strategy standpoint. And once again, I know nothing about battle strategy. But isn't it better?
We're going to have some generals writing in.
Yeah, please do.
To explain why I'm wrong.
Some lieutenants, please. Isn't it better from a battle strategy to have your enemy think you know, come at you wary rather than come at you 100% confident that they're going to quash you.
Yeah.
And then if they come at you wary, then you can pull a sort of Home Alone thing where you put some like cardboard cutouts in the windows and no, I'm just kidding. They're not going
to. I guess it just, you're right. It could theoretically make a difference. I just feel like the difference like,
is
in
not
the end,
risk.
Yeah, in the end, it's not going to make that much of a difference.
Trudging out to Caster's Keep, which apparently takes a season to get back from.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's, in the end, it doesn't feel like it's going to make a big difference. Like, he's going to come at you with all he's got, and you're either going to be able to survive it or not. And whether or not he knows you have 100 guys is not going to make a huge difference. But Jonah, explain. Like, does this happen in the book as well? Like, what's going
no,
on?
No, we're off the map. We're off the map.
Oh, really? Okay. So... okay, so this is a deviation from the book that is not good then.
Honestly, I think they're trying to stretch things.
I see.
A bit.
All right. Oh. Well, hopefully they do a better job as we progress through this episode. But please, if you guys think this plotline makes a lot of sense, write in. And I'm happy to be proven wrong. Okay, and there was a scene with Arya and the Hound. And they meet this farmer who offers them... a knight and some rabbit stew, and you know, the Hound just like jacks their stuff. It just takes him and runs away. And I guess like that's what I was referencing at the beginning of this episode is that every character, right? Sam and the Hound and Baelish, and like in case you were just starting to like any of these people. Just remember, like, they're all... or Jamie, right? They're all horrible, horrible human beings. Go ahead. Joanna, you object?
I think it's more complicated than that.
Okay. Yeah.
I
don't disagree that it's more complicated than that. I'm just saying, like, that's the impression I got, was that it was kind of trying to subvert some of your...
That's language I'm more comfortable with. Subvert yes. some of your expectations when you start to hero worship a character, like when you start to believe wholly in the redemption of Jaime Lannister,
right.
You're in danger. When you start to put any of these characters up as heroes, when you start, you know, if you root wholeheartedly for Arya without concern for her mortal soul and like the corruption that's happening there, you don't have quite a grasp on the morally ambiguous world that George R. R. Martin right. is building here.
Yes. Okay. That's a far better and more articulate way of putting what I was trying to say. But yes, I think we are in agreement.
Basically, so, we agree. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is this moment when like Arya was like pointing out how good the soup was. It's just amazing because it was almost like, you could see the actress Maisie Williams kind of saying that. You know what I mean? Like, it was such a... I guess it's been a while since we've seen her react like that in any way. So I just thought that was hilarious. That whole scene I thought was really funny. Do you agree that that was, like... Did you enjoy that scene with the farmer at the table?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I agree wholeheartedly with the Hound. Like, what kind of monster doesn't keep ale in their house? Really?
Yeah. I mean, really? That's the worst thing ever.
Yeah.
My heart did sink, though. I knew when this guy mentioned he had silver, I was like, why did you say that out loud to this guy who clearly has the ability to take you out?
Yeah.
That was a bad move. These guys were clearly too trusting. On that note, by the way, what an incredible scene. We actually didn't even talk about this. What an incredible scene with this random village of people, right? That happened before the Castle Black scene where this father and his son are just having a grand old time talking about like the soup that they're going to have for dinner. And then boom, this kid's life is just changed in an instant.
Oof. Yeah.
That was such a well done scene. I thought
it
like,
was so good
because
like,
of how horrifying
potatoes, and then death
because of how horrifying it was, and like the kid, his mom, and his dad are just killed in that one scene. And I am curious if that kid is going to become a recurring character because there is a shot where it fixates on Ygritte, and again, you realize like Ygritte's, you know, we see her primarily as a love interest, but she's not above just totally slaughtering innocent people.
Well, once again, that's that nuance.
Right.
Yep. Of like, you know, you come to think of Ygritte as, oh, you know, adorable redheaded scamp who's in love with Jon Snow. But yeah, I mean, she's
a cold-hearted killer, basically.
She can be.
Yeah. And so there's a scene where it like fixates on her. And it's this kid is becoming the next Arya, essentially, is kind of like what I got there. Was he's looking at this woman who killed his father and plotting his revenge. I mean, I guess part of it is he's in shock and in trauma, but I feel like that he's laying the groundwork for revenge at some point in the future. Whether or not that's I don't even know if we're ever going to see that kid again in the show, but I thought it was certainly a possibility based on how that scene treated that kid. Anyway, going back to this rabbit stew scene, they did have this chat. You know, Arya is kind of the audience surrogate, basically accusing the Hound of being a complete dick.
The biggest shit in the Seven Kingdoms, yeah. I think is what she said. Yeah.
And I think all the people in the audience are hard-pressed to agree, or, you know, it's hard to disagree.
Well, on the one hand, yes. But on the other hand, the Hound is not wrong in some of his assessment.
Right, because we've seen in this episode, like, innocent people brutally slaughtered. For no reason, right?
Absolutely. Who are just not going to make it. Yeah. These are the people, this is the cannon fodder of this war, and they're not going to make it. And yeah. I mean, it's a little more poignant that these were House Tully people. These were her mother's people. And yeah. But yeah, I mean, Maisie Williams is great in this episode.
Yeah.
And Rory McCann too, so.
All right. And fine. Go ahead. Were you going to say something?
Well, have we talked enough about Tyrion and Pod and that whole scene before we get to that other scene?
Yeah, I don't think we have. I mean, it was a really touching scene, just and an awesome scene because this is a character who your view as a viewer, I feel like, or as a viewer, I'll just speak for myself. My affection for Pod really snuck up on me, right? Like, he's a character that. You meet, I think, in season two, I want to say, right? Like, he's kind of at the fringes of season two, but continues to come back and again, and always makes a slight impression every time he appears on screen. But he rarely has any big moments except for when he had the whole sex thing, right? And he was a sexual
He
god.
Saved Tyrion the Battle of the Blackwater.
That's right. That's right. Apologies. So I guess he does have a couple of big moments. But I would argue
No, but
that
I agree that he's an unexpected favorite.
Right. I would argue that for most of the times you see him, he's not doing anything particularly dramatic or making that huge of an impression.
Right.
But now that this is like goodbye between the two of them, who knows if they'll ever see each other again, it really did hit me because, yeah, this has been an awesome, loyal character. It's been built up for years very well. And, you know, the performance is great too. It's a really poignant moment and really well executed in the show. What'd you think?
Yeah, I thought it was great. Just a really, really lovely scene. And I actually really like the way it was shot too, with Pod standing and Tyrion sitting and just sort of that whole thing. I don't know if we've talked about it enough on the show, but just this notion that Pod is distantly related to Illyn Payne, who's the man who chopped off Ned Stark's head. So not connected in any like really strong way, but they share the same last name. And I think that's important only in this idea that just because, you know, when you think Lannister, you think a certain association. When you think Stark, you think a certain association. But I like this dynamic that there's Illyn Payne, who's a very nefarious character on the show. And then Podrick Payne, who's this, you know, saintly character, sharing the same last name.
It's the duality of man in this one family. yeah, great scene. Really well done. Loved it. Loved it. It was so great. And then so the final scene in the episode is Dany arrives at Meereen and they send out this champion to fight Dany. It's pretty awesome. Dario is bad at it. Like, it's actually, I thought it was quite humorous how all these guys are volunteering. And Dany kept saying, no, I can't lose you because blah. And then the one dude who she actually has a thing for, she's like, I guess you're the one that I don't mind dying. And Dario takes out that guy in the most badass way imaginable. I really enjoyed this whole sequence. I mean, the tableau of this guy with on a horse against this enormous rock face, that was just so beautiful. Like, just that they found this location, like, amazing location. Just that they found this location, and they framed it by putting this tiny guy on a horse in front of it. It just looked spectacular, and I loved it.
Did you? You didn't watch any of the previews for this season, did you?
No, didn't.
Yeah, this is one of the shots that they use sort of over and over again in the previews. Is that man riding out with his lance against that cliff face?
Oh yeah, I watched a trailer. I didn't watch that like 20-minute preview. I watched the first trailer.
Yeah,
And it looks so good. It's so beautiful. Like, it's
it really
beautiful.
Is. And also, I definitely, you know, I know they sometimes do behind the making of segments on HBO or HBO Go. I really want to learn more about that horse, like the whole stunt with the horse. And, you know, I'm sure there's CG involved, right. But it looked so good.
Yeah, a lot of it looked pretty good.
Yeah.
I don't think they really threw a dagger into the horse's face, though, is what I would guess.
I doubt any horses were harmed in the making of the Siege of Marine here. But, and then Dario sort of scything off his head was good times. So.
And then Danny gives this amazing speech completely in a fictional language.
Hi, Valyrian. That's my favorite thing that Emilia Clarke does. I think it's the best thing that she does, actually.
And wow, like, that is tough, man. Like, think about, like, the multiple levels of difficulty there. Number one, she has to be a total badass, which would be difficult enough in English. But she has to speak in a language that has never been heard, really. I mean, it's not a real language, right?
Unlike Klingon, it's not a real language.
Right, exactly. And she has to make it sound badass even in that language. She has to convince you that, A, she knows what she's saying in this other language that you've never heard of, and B, still sound badass. And I would say she pulled it off really well. I mean, there was a few moments that were kind of shaky, but overall, it was really, really well done. I thought she did a great job. So it was pretty awesome final sequence altogether.
I saw some funny comments about the acoustics, how the acoustics must be really good in that canyon for her to be able to project the way that she was projecting.
It was like in Gladiator, right? Like that movie Gladiator when the characters speak in the Colosseum without the aid of any amplification.
Yeah, exactly.
It was like, okay, well, you just kind of have to buy that. You just have to buy it. It was kind of one thing that did occur to me is, what is her mission here? Is it just to make things really, really awkward between the slaves and their slave owners? Because I think that's what she's certainly doing.
Yeah, like foment rebellion, right. I think. The book nerd thing that I will say is there's a character that they've cut out of the show, and I don't 100% mind that they've cut him out of the show, but instead of Dario fighting the champion of Marine, it's this character named Strong Bellus, who is this big hulking character that they've cut out of Danny's retinue. And instead of peeing, he actually like takes a dump and wipes his ass with the flag of the champion that he has bested. So, you know, for those who say that HBO
always makes things worse.
Yeah, always pushes the boundaries. At least this was just some urination and not defecation.
I bet you never thought you'd be saying those words, but
yeah. And also, I don't think this is a spoiler to say that because there was like a big enough shot of it, but in the Marine crowd, book readers might want to rewatch that and look for people.
All right. So then she launches all this stuff, and I was like, what is going on? And turns out it's the chains, the broken shackles of the slaves that she's freed.
Do you think that one or two slaves might have been wounded by all of that stuff falling down?
I was just thinking, like, wow, this is a lot of effort just to make this point.
Symbol.
But
someone definitely got hit by flying broken barrel shrapnel, right?
I don't think we actually see that happen on screen.
No, we didn't. I'm just saying there's no way you lob a bunch of barrels at people filled with iron shackles and not – anyway. That's an interesting, yes.
The Unsullied, have surgical aim, obviously. But I mean, it's just like, wow, this is really important to her. I mean, I think we already all knew that, but just when you are attacking someone, you know, you have limited amount of time and resources to launch things at them so that she would spend all this time launching these chains. I guess, I mean, I don't know
that's
that.
That's so Danny, though.
Yeah, of course, of course. I mean, I guess I don't know that, like, is this the type of show where these people will just rise up against their leaders and fight them? I feel like that would stretch credibility a little bit, but who knows? Maybe they want freedom that badly. Like, I guess one of the issues is we don't really see, like, how bad their mistreatment is in the show. And so we don't really understand kind of the mindset of these people. But who knows? I have no idea. Maybe it's all going to make sense next week.
Well, I feel like you can just extrapolate from what we've seen in previous Slaver cities.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And it's been pretty bad.
Yeah, and they were really, really happy about her freeing them at the end of the last season. So I can imagine that these slaves and Marine would do the same. So I really love the way this scene ended. I have no real problems with it whatsoever. It's just a great ending. Jonah Robinson, we are 1 hour in, and we haven't even gotten to the most controversial thing of this episode yet.
Yeah, you're right.
So here we go. Let's dive into this. There's a lot to unpack here. All right. So let me begin. Do you want to begin? Do you want to drive, or should I begin?
No, you take the wheel.
I'll take the wheel here. Okay. So after Jaime sends out everyone, the septons or whatever, from Joffrey's grave, there's a scene where Cersei asks Jaime to kill Tyrion, which, by the way, you know, I mentioned this last week. It's not a hugely insightful observation to say that Tyrion is smarter than killing Joffrey, like, right in front of him, where he could easily be implicated and arrested.
And Tyrion says as much.
He says the exact same thing, right? And yeah. I don't think any of us actually think that Tyrion actually did this, because we all know how smart Tyrion is. We don't think he actually did this. Not smart enough to not get framed for it, but smart enough to not actually do it at this place, like people think he did, or at least like Cersei did, thinks he did. Cersei asks Jaime to kill Tyrion and avenge Joffrey, their son. To my recollection, Jaime doesn't actually agree one way or the other. Tries to object, actually. And they embrace, and Jaime...
Well, this is... right before we get into this, this is just the quick parallel that I want to draw between Tywin manipulating Tommen the way that he does in the previous scene, and then Cersei... Okay, and then I am in no way saying that... I don't want to relate what I'm about to say here to what happens next. I want to talk about them as two very distinct things.
Yep.
But before what happens next happens, Cersei is manipulating Jaime to the best of her ability. She's being as tender to him as she has been since she's seen him return, in the hopes that he will murder Tyrion for her. You know, she's like, he killed our son, our boy, you know, like all this stuff. And it's a, you know, yes, softened by grief, but it's also just a different attitude than Cersei's had this entire time she's seen Jaime. So.
That's interesting. I did not read that scene that way at all.
Her emotionally manipulating Jaime?
Correct.
Like, okay.
That did not even cross my mind. Like, I don't know if that didn't even cross my mind, but it's her actions struck me as totally plausible actions of a grieving mother. Like, okay. It did not strike me as, oh, she's pulling out all the stops and manipulating him. I just thought, oh, this is totally what someone in that situation would do if they were really pissed off at the death of their son. That's kind of that was my take on it. But your take was different.
And once again, I don't think what follows has really... I'm not connecting those two things.
So they embrace and they start making out, and then Cersei pulls away from him because I guess Cersei's conclusion is that she does not think that's the appropriate time to do that, right? And, you know, here's what I saw unfold. And you may have a different version of what you saw unfold, and I think Alex Graves has a different version of what he saw unfold, the director of this episode. But I saw Jamie getting upset that Cersei had deprived him of her, and you know, trying and essentially raping her. Really, is what like my perception was, that he ripped off her clothes despite her numerous protestations, and had his way with her, like on the ground there. That was my perception of it. Like she was objecting on numerous levels. I think one thing that I thought was telling was like she was saying, "Not here, not now." I think is what she said right at some point.
Does she say that?
Does she? Okay,
that might be book language.
Okay, well maybe I should.
In the show, I remember her saying, "No, this is wrong.
This is wrong. This is wrong." Right. So I think like one way of interpreting that is like the implication is that like one possible implication from that, is that, she's saying that like she's not opposed to the idea of being with Jamie, but that the way it's happening, which is to say next to the body of her dead son, is like not the way she wants it to happen.
I disagree. Like, I just feel that if you watch the show without any book knowledge at all, you wouldn't extrapolate that.
Correct. Correct.
You would just see a woman saying no,
right,
and getting raped.
I agree, and I'm saying like that is how I perceived it. I'm just I'm trying to parse out like some of the different ways that the scene has been interpreted.
And here's my objection to that, which is that what I've gotten really tired of today is people trying in a million different ways to define what is rape and what isn't. And it's actually made me quite angry. I don't mean to like say that I'm angry at you, Dave, at all, but like, I just think that that's a very dangerous conversation to have. And I think, you know, you were going to bring up what director Alex Graves said about this scene. And I think that has made this whole controversy 1,000 times worse.
Yeah. Like if he hadn't said this at all, I mean, we might be talking about the scene as shocking, but I don't think we would be talking about it in the same. I don't think there would be a bunch of think pieces about it like there are.
Well, no, I mean, the AV Club piece from Sonia, what's Sonia's last name? Do you have it handy?
I do, but I wouldn't know how to pronounce it. But Sonia S.
Okay.
From AV Club.
And it's the title's Rape of Thrones. She wrote that, I believe, before The Hollywood Reporter really posted that, and Sepinwall. On HitFix really posted the response from Alex Gray. Sonia wrote that before. Her AV Club piece went up very early last night because I think she had seen a screener. And so she's writing mainly from the point of view of a book reader who objects to the different interpretation. Am I wrong about that?
I think you're correct about that. But let me read Alex Graves' quote.
Yeah.
So okay. We can have some context.
Get context,
here,
okay? Yeah.
So Alex Graves gave an interview to Alan Sepinwall. This was actually a while ago.
Right.
I think before the season even began on HBO.
Right, because the first three episodes were released as screeners. Right. So Sepinwall would have seen this episode.
And Alex Graves, the director, said, quote, about the encounter. He says, quote, "It becomes consensual by the end. Because anything for them ultimately results in a turn-on, especially a power struggle. Nobody really wanted to talk about what was going on between the two characters. So we had a rehearsal that was a blocking rehearsal. And it was very much about the earlier part with Charles Dance, the gentle verbal kidnapping of Cersei's last living son. Nikolai, who plays Jamie, came in and we just went through one physical progression and digression of what they went through. But also, how to do it with only one hand, because it was Nikolai. By the time you do that and you walk through it, the actors feel comfortable going home to think about it. The only other thing I did was that ordinarily, you rehearse the night before, and I wanted to rehearse that scene 4 days before so that we could think about everything. And it worked out really well. That's one of my favorite scenes I've ever done." End quote. So the implication is that he thinks that it starts out as rapey and ends as consensual. Like, she starts out resisting him, and by the end, she's into it. Like, that's kind of my perception of what he intended with that scene. Is that correct? Would you agree with that? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. Sonia Soraya, that's her last name, I think, apologies if I'm mispronouncing. She wrote this great piece. I really thought this was a insightful piece called Rape of Thrones at avclub.com, where she points out numerous instances in which the show has deviated from the book in ways that appear to be more misogynistic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is this scene, which in the book, she gives the copy from the book, I think, right?
Some of it.
In the book, it is pretty... I think the book, it very clearly is what Alex Graves describes he was intending to do in the show.
See, and once again, like, this is where I deviate from what a lot of people think. Sorry, I should let you finish what you're saying.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
I think it's rape in the book, and I think it's rape in the show. And I think it's... I think this is where we get into that conversation, which I don't like, which is what exactly constitutes rape. But there's language in the book where she says no, she's pounding on his chest, and he doesn't even hear her and is proceeding. And I actually, I just think that there are people who are so invested in the redemption arc of Jaime Lannister that they're willing to look past that. And this is not... what most people are saying about this scene. And so I feel a little uncomfortable because I don't want to seem like I'm okay with any kind of rape. I'm not. In fact, I think the book scene is very disturbing, and I think the show scene is very disturbing. And if we had just left it at that, at the book scene being slightly more nuanced, but one way, and the show scene being a different way, I would have found them relatively consistent, honestly, with the way in which the TV medium flattens morality. Alex Graves weighing in complicates it very much from my point of view, but I don't see this as a character assassination of Jaime Lannister. Jaime Lannister is someone who threw a kid out of a window. Like, Jaime Lannister is someone who murdered his cousin with his own bare hands, like, very recently on the show. So I just think that people fell in love with this concept of nice Jaime Lannister and are very upset to see him engaged in this.
And they're shipping, like, Jaime and Brienne.
Yeah, which, you've heard me talk about it. I am well into Jaime and Brienne. But as we mentioned earlier in the show, George R. R. Martin is not telling you a story of a man who was redeemed by his, like, meeting this badass lady knight. Like, that's not the story he's telling. And the other book difference, which is worth noting, is that this is Jaime's first encounter with Cersei in the books. He doesn't come back earlier in the books. He comes back now. So he hasn't seen her in forever. And George R. R. Martin, in his response today, which he posted in a comment on his blog, he talked about the butterfly effect of if they change one thing in the show, which is bringing Jaime back early, then it changes the whole flavor of that scene that you see. So,
well,
I don't know. I just feel like I said
a lot. Wait, hold on, slow down there. So what was he saying about that scene? Like, so I agree that if this was the first he had seen of Cersei, that scene would make more sense. I mean, okay, so I'm sorry. Finish what you're saying. I have some more thoughts to share. Finish what you're saying, though.
Well, do you want me to read out what George R. R. Martin said?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. He says, I think the butterfly effect that I've spoken of so often was at work here. In the novels, Jaime's not present at Joffrey's death, and indeed, Cersei had been fearful that he is dead himself, and that she has lost both the son and the father, lover, brother. And then suddenly, Jaime is there before her, maimed and changed, but Jaime nonetheless. Though the time and place is wildly inappropriate and Cersei is fearful of discovery, she is as hungry for him as he is for her. The whole dynamic is different in the show, where Jaime has been back for weeks at least, maybe longer, and he and Cersei have been in each other's company on numerous occasions, often quarreling. The setting is the same, but neither characters in the same places in the books, which might be why Dan and David played the sept out differently. But that's my surmise. We've never discussed the scene to the best of my recollection. And then he also mentions the other point that people have been discussing today, which is that the scene in the book is from Jaime's point of view. So he says, I was writing the scene from Jaime's point of view, so the reader is inside his head hearing his thoughts. On the TV show, the camera is necessarily external. You don't know what anyone is thinking or feeling, just what they are saying and doing. If the show had retained some of Cersei's dialogue from the books, it might have helped it might have left a somewhat different impression, but that dialogue is very much shaped by the circumstances of the books, delivered by a woman who is seeing her lover again for the first time after a long while apart, during which she feared he was dead. I'm not sure it would have worked the same in the new timeline. That's really all I can say on the issue. The scene was always intended to be disturbing, but I do regret if it has disturbed people for the wrong reasons.
Right, right. So he's not even defending the scene. Right, he's just saying, like,
nor is he really damning. He sort of took a middle line, I think, a bit.
Right.
But he's just, I think he's kind of distancing himself from it.
Yeah.
Saying, this isn't the story I wrote.
Right.
I also wrote a disturbing scene, but it wasn't this disturbing scene.
Right. Yep. That makes complete sense. I mean, I think a couple of things are undoubtedly true. Number one, Alice Graves' intention did not come across on screen at all for the vast majority of people who watch this scene, right?
Agreed. Yes.
And that is unfortunate for a wide variety of reasons. I mean, his remarks kind of color your perception of the scene and his remarks seem weirdly insensitive in the context of what we saw on the episode this week, right?
He also talks about, I think it was in the Hollywood Reporter interview, where he talks about how they were laughing while, like, filming that scene. And I just don't know that that's necessarily something worth sharing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was incredibly troubling to me. Like, the scene itself was incredibly troubling to me.
Yeah.
Just to watch it, because it's so disturbing that he would do this right next to Joffrey's dead body and over the protestations of Cersei. It just, it felt like the show had sunk to almost a new low. And I don't say that, I'm not saying that, like, disparagingly. I'm just saying, like, this show has mined the depths of human depravity. And so this is, like, it's almost going toward, like, on another level to show this. And so for Graves to come out and say, hey, it was actually consensual, it just seemed very, very incongruous. But here's the second point I'll make. I don't think this was character assassination. And I agree, like, Jamie has done some terrible things, but it did kind of come out of nowhere. For me, as a viewer, like a book reader, I think, who is it? Someone wrote in, here we go. George from the UK writes in, one of the things that most interests me about Jamie was that his twisted, creepy relationship with his sister was one of the most chivalrous, romantic relationships in the story. I guess that's out the window, and that wasn't a deliberate brand joke, but I'm not taking it out. What's the payoff? Some extra shock value? I would have thought that some consensual banging right next to their dead son would have some pretty damn shocking imagery by itself.
Go ahead.
No, you go. Go ahead.
Well, I just don't. I feel like a lot of people are making assumptions as to why. I have other ideas as to why they did this. I don't know. I can't say. But to assume that they just put it in there, like a really dark rape scene just to shock people, that, I mean, honestly, if you would say they put this scene in there just to titillate people, I'd say, yes, that seems consistent with Game of Thrones. And maybe I'm wrong. You know, they did add a stabbing of a pregnant woman to the Red Wedding just to make it that much worse.
Right.
Just to raise the bar. So possibly they put this in here just to raise the bar. But I also think they put it in a flattened moral way where you couldn't justify it to cure us of our temptation to create heroes in a story where there really aren't heroes.
And it sounds really good and useful and effective storytelling as you say it that way, but I do think there's an argument to be made that we've seen Jaime be pretty loving to Cersei and has gone to great lengths to protect the virtue of Brienne. So that he would just, I think there's two layers, right? There's like, what did the show runners intend to show, and what is it that we actually saw, right?
Exactly.
And okay. So
and
if
that's,
the showrunners,
that's what makes this conversation so hard.
It does. And so, like, it's very difficult for me to not talk about that scene like it was a rape, because that's what I witnessed, right? Like, that's my perception of it.
I mean, what I'm gonna say is that in my opinion, even if Cersei, quote unquote, got into it later, that's still a sexual assault.
Right.
You know, I still feel it's a sexual assault in the book. So, and this is where the shades of rape discussion really bothers me.
Right. Yeah.
No. But I hear what you're saying. Like, violent. Well, no. Once again, the shades of rape. I don't know how to talk about this. But we can agree that Alex Graves described something that none of us watching the show saw. I don't think anyone watching the show saw that.
Right. And I think that. Okay, so the point I was going to make is I think there is an argument to be made that we've seen Jamie be evil in a bunch of ways, but even when he pushes Bran out a window, it's to protect his relationship with Cersei. So that he would do this thing to jeopardize that relationship. I mean, even if Alex Graves was right, like, effectively convey what he is doing, it just does seem to come a little bit out of nowhere in the context of the show. I think that is a valid criticism of that, like, putting aside that whole the whole sexual assault thing, I think it's a valid criticism that, like, this character would behave in a way that we don't – that conflicts with what we've seen before of this character.
Well, I disagree only because we saw Cersei and Jaime interact very early on in season one, and we have not seen them interact until the end of last season. And in that time, Jaime went through an arc, right? An undeniable character arc. So to see him behave differently towards her than we saw him behave in season one makes complete sense to me. And what I have always interpreted in that scene as a disappointing tumble from grace in Jaime is he has this sort of stereotypical redemptive arc in his time with Brienne, and then he's back in King's Landing in the corrosive influence of his family. And it sounds so nonchalant to describe a rape as a lapse, but a relapse. But it seems to me to be him falling back into the nastier side of his nature. This is a guy, I mean, yeah, he pushed a kid out of a window for his, like, sister lover. I don't understand people defending that as a virtuous act. And I've seen that a lot today.
No, but
I can understand Jaime pushing Bran out of a window, but I can't understand him raping Cersei.
Well, I think the idea is that he's pushing Bran out of a window to protect his relationship with Cersei. So why would he then turn around and jeopardize the one thing?
Because he's a different person now than he was then.
He's a what?
He's a different person now than he was then.
I mean, would you argue that he's a worse person?
I would argue that it's difficult, but I would argue that in raping Cersei here, it's a violent act towards his former self. It's a corruptive act towards something that he once thought was virtuous, but which he knows now to be wrong.
Okay. I mean, I guess I just,
that's like a huge extrapolation.
So right. I think, like, yeah, I just don't read the scene for, again, like, let's even assume that it is sexual assault. I just don't read it that way. Like, I don't agree that, because I guess my perception is that when this character goes through this arc and he's a different person, he theoretically should become a better person. This is like Michael Douglas's arc in The Game, right? The David Fincher movie. It's like when this character has everything.
This is the third time we're talking. Oh no, maybe it's somewhere else. The Game keeps coming up in my life. Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
When a character has everything taken away from him, like, they tend to get humble and appreciative of everything they do have.
But you're talking about the straightforward moral rules of a different kind of universe.
Okay, I guess. But I'm saying even in the twisted moral universe of Game of Thrones, it just does, like, when you said, like, that this is, in the book, is the first time that they'd seen each other, it all locked into place for me. Like, that. Oh, I hear that and I think, oh, well, that makes complete sense. Whereas in the show, it just doesn't really make much sense, is what I'm saying. Like, I'm saying in the context of the show, I agree with George R. R. Martin. It doesn't really make much sense, which I think is what he was kind of saying.
But right. Not. But I also this goes back to what I was saying before about, and once again, like, I hate to come off like I'm defending this scene that I thought was really repugnant. So I don't really mean that. But what I mean is that it's, there are clear line of motivation in the book, but it's still disturbing. And I think people would not be as dis- I think it's meant to trouble you, and it's meant to put you off Jamie Lannister. And I feel like maybe they felt like they needed to go to some sort of extreme in order to do that. I'm not 100% sure why they brought Jamie Lannister back to King's Landing when they did. And that has yet to play out.
Well, okay, couple things. First of all, I surmise is that if you didn't bring Jamie Lannister back to King's Landing, it would have been this episode when you saw him. So it would be three episodes in to the show until you see him. And I think that whether for contract reasons or maybe because they knew that that was one of the plot lines we invested in the most, it would have been weird to not see him for three episodes.
I don't know. We could have, give the audience what they want, which is more Jamie and Brienne on the road.
True enough. And I guess, yeah, you're right. They did bring him back at the end of last season, not at the beginning of this
one. Right.
That I think of it. I like what you're saying in theory, Joanna. I just don't think that's how it played out in the show. Like, you're saying, the showrunners had this purpose of making Jamie blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, I agree that is what they intended. I just don't think they did a good job of it. Like, you still have responsibility as a storyteller for the character motivations to make sense and to make sense to the viewer in the context of the show. And I don't think that they did a good job. So I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on this one.
But I mean, we don't disagree entirely.
Yeah. Well, what do you think we agree on?
That whatever it is that Alex Graves is trying to do did not come across.
Correct. But I think that's not an achievement that we agree on that, because I think a lot of people feel that way. So,
okay. Anyway,
any other closing thoughts? You can have the last word, Joanna. Any other closing thoughts?
Just that I'm still sussing out my thoughts on this, and I really do welcome people's feedback. And if I have said anything, just know that I know that this is a very sensitive topic and a triggering topic for some people. And so if I came off as cavalier in any way while trying to grapple with this, it was not my intention. I take this subject very seriously. This conversation went back and forth, I don't know, for the last like 24 hours, basically. I've been having this conversation with people. Anyway, it's just it's a really hard thing to talk about.
It is like the third rail of podcast topics, because like it's highly likely that we've said something that's offended someone, and it's not our intention at all.
Right.
It's a difficult topic to discuss. It's very challenging. We've tried our best to be sensitive about it, and if we've failed in any way, apologies for that. Let us know how we can improve. And share with us your thoughts on, you know.
Yeah, I'm really. We got a lot of emails in advance of this, but I'm actually even more interested in what we get after this conversation, because as you said earlier, I'm still working through my interpretation and my feelings on this. So.
Yeah, and our reactions can be complex to things, and sometimes you may not feel the same. You may not feel the same way next week, Joanna Robinson.
I may not. After reading people's emails, please do let us know.
And send those emails to acastofkings@gmail.com. All right, Joanna Robinson, I think we're going to have to,
end on this huge downer.
Yeah, end on this huge downer. I don't think there's going to be time for clips this episode, because we've been just going for a long time.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to put this out immediately after this episode, but after we record this, I should say. But you want to let people know where they can find more of your work, Joanna Robinson?
Every day on vanityfair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
Find me at DaveChen.net, at Dave Chensky on Twitter and on YouTube, and also find the video we made together at Facebook.com/acastofkings or Twitter.com/acastofkings. A lot of people are giving me crap about saying your whole name, Joanna Robinson. The objections are more vehement and less understanding this year. But people should know that the request only emboldened me further. So, anyway, that's all for this week's episode. And on that note, that's all for this week's episode of A Cast of Kings. Thanks for listening. We'll see you guys next week.